We're talking about toxic PCB cleanup in the Fox River. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The paper companies responsible for the pollution in the Fox River had been fighting in court for decades over who should pay what in the cleanup of toxic PCBs. And those are those man-made chemicals that were discharged through wastewater in the papermaking process, especially in the 60s. So the settlement is now inked. A judge signed off on what is expected to cost more than $1.2 billion in remaining remediation. And we're wondering how to deal with this legacy pollution. With your thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. Do you remember learning about PCBs and how they were found to be hazardous to human health? What did it feel like when you realized that was happening in your water? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Julia Nordyke is a water quality and coastal communities outreach specialist at the UW Sea Grant Institute. Julia, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
So under the terms of this settlement that was approved last week, these paper companies will be paying for these cleanup costs. And this is pollution that took place from the mid-50s until 71. What is the significance of this settlement?
Oh, this is an absolutely momentous milestone right now. This is bringing to a close probably the biggest cleanup, PCB cleanup in the world. So it's exciting.
The biggest PCB cleanup in the world. So this is going to be a process that takes a while, but it's expected to be completed in 2020. It calls for these paper companies to pay for the cost to do this. And which has been an ongoing fight for decades. What do we know about what this cleanup will entail?
Well, they've actually been really working on the cleanup since about 2009. And so it's been going on a decade, but that's when the major PCB cleanup started for the Fox River. And they've been dredging 13 miles of the river. And during the season, they've been working 24 hours a day, 5 days a week, and sometimes they transport up to, 224 trucks a day from the facility out. So
they're dredging the river, and what are they doing through that dredging? What does that accomplish?
Well, when the PCBs were released into the river, they were absorbed into the sediments at the bottom. And so those toxins really take a long time to break down. And without actually getting them out of the river, they could leave a legacy of pollution that would continuously contribute to ecological and human health hazards.
And so they dredge, and then through that dredging, are there any other things that they're doing as part of this cleanup, or is it specifically the dredging?
The dredging is a big portion of it, and so what they're doing is a pretty incredible process. They have basically an underwater vacuum, so that's going for miles and miles up the river. Right now they're closer to the mouth of the river because it's coming to a close, but they started 13 miles, upriver, and that vacuum sucks up the dredged sediment from the bottom that's contaminated using GPS or global positioning satellite in exact spots. And that sediment is actually sucked up to the Green Bay processing facility where it's dewatered and then also separated for sand and then regular sediment that's contaminated. And then really the water is drawn completely out into these cakes. And then from there it's shipped off to a landfill depending on its toxicity levels. In addition to the dredging, they're actually in some spots where it's more cost-effective and or just really logistically challenging to do dredging, but potentially the contaminated sediments really, really deep. In those cases, they're doing capping using sand, rock, and gravel.
So when you take the sediment out, what happens in place of it? Like, what happens to the river?
Eventually we have, in our system, we actually have a lot of more sediment just coming into the system. We live in our valley. We have a lot of agriculture, and right now, actually, agricultural runoff is contributing a lot of that soil back into the river system. And so we are getting natural sediments coming through Lake Winnebago and down the river. And then also, as part of the cleanup, they're doing habitat restoration efforts on the bottom to remediate what was lost in the past. So it could be fish enhancements or it could be some of this capping. And so they're kind of reconstructing the bottom of the river, too. But eventually, through natural processes and erosion from upstream, the bottom of the river will continue to have sediment and sand.
What do we know about the health of the Fox River today? How is it doing?
Well, this is a gigantic step in the right direction for the PCB cleanup, but our main challenges going forward are going to be agricultural runoff and also our municipalities. So we actually have limitations on pollutants for sediment or soil loss erosion, and then also phosphorus. And those two things, sediment comes down and when it rains or the snow melts in these big quantities, and that can really cover up a lot of the aquatic life in at the bottom of the bay. The phosphorus kind of acts as we all know, it's a good nutrient for potentially our lawns or our gardens. And so when too much of that gets into the bay, we start to see problems with overgrowth of blue-green algae. And those can cause a lot of problems in terms of public health and ecological health, too. So those break down. When they die, they sink to the bottom. And then as they decompose, they suck up oxygen, and they can create these dead zones in the Bay of Green Bay. And then also when blue-green algae dies, it releases what's called cyanotoxins that can also pose public health concerns for folks in terms of neuro and liver toxicity and gastrointestinal issues.
We're talking with Julia Nordyke. She's a water quality and coastal communities outreach specialist at the UW Sea Grant Institute. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you work for a paper company in the 60s? Do you work for a paper company now? What's your opinion on the Fox River PCB pollution and the cleanup process? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Mary Kay now, joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay.
Good morning. I don't understand why they don't test to find out what chemicals in there. Then the company, the pharmacy, the agricultural, the manufacturers of the product, the chemical, they can have a man-made pond on their property and put it in containers so they're not contaminating other water sources.
And so you want more testing done, it sounds like, Mary, to find out exactly what is in this water?
Absolutely. And then, of course, you would bring the company, you know, the pharmacies, all those people who have to pay for it because they're improperly disposing their product.
Julia, what do we know about testing and responsibility?
Well, I mean, this is a long story, at least here in the Fox Valley and with the Fox River. And, you know, back around the early 70s, that's when scientists across the nation started realizing the impacts of PCBs on our wildlife and particularly fish-eating birds. And so it wasn't until, you know, they eventually banned the use of PCBs. But the industries in general were not required to test their discharge or restricted in their discharge at that point. Just the use of PCBs were banned. And so it wasn't until, you know, the university system, Sea Grant, in partnership with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, started to look at the impacts of PCBs on the Fox River and the Green Bay system, when they started to really find out what was happening here in our system. So those kind of led to this, you know, public outcry of support of saying this isn't, you know, we need to start dealing with this.
We're talking about PCB cleanup in the Fox River and how to repair decades of environmental damage after toxic chemicals were discharged in the water. Julia Nordyke is a water quality and coastal communities outreach specialist at the UW Sea Grant Institute. You can join in as well. Do you live in Green Bay or near the Fox River? Have you lived there a long time? What are your memories of paper companies' pollution and cleanup efforts? We're at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about toxic PCBs in the Fox River and the remediation steps ahead. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. PCBs are these toxic man-made chemicals that were used in the paper industry, mainly in the 50s and 60s, to make carbonless paper. The chemicals are dangerous to human health, and they were banned in the U.S. in 1979. And the Fox River has been the site of the largest cleanup of contaminated sediments of its kind in the U.S. We're gathering your thoughts on remediation and the stages going forward at 800-642-1234. What is your opinion on the Fox River PCB pollution? What do you think are the biggest lessons we've learned from the Fox River and the Green Bay pollution? Join in at 800-642-1234. Julia Nordyke is a water quality and coastal communities outreach specialist at UW Sea Grant Institute. Can you help us understand a little bit more what PCBs are?
Sure. PCBs are a chemical compound. They're polychlorinated biphenyls, and they were used traditionally. They were created and used in electrical equipment and hydraulic equipment. They are also used in the papermaking process to produce carbonless, carbon-free or carbonless copy paper. And so this was the kind of chemical they were used. So then they, you know, as they use this, they discharge it in their wastewater. And then also around here, we had, you know, the Fox River has the highest density of paper mills in the country or in the world, actually. And they would recycle a lot of the paper around here. And then it was also released in the discharges into the river.
What do we know about the impact to human health with PCBs?
They've been found to be cancer-causing and then also potentially related to development disabilities and or developmental growth. And then also they really impact wildlife, too, and particularly fish-eating birds. And so they are at the bottom of the river, and they're at these sediments, and they kind of are at the bottom of the food chain. And as these little microorganisms eat them and the little plankton and then the fish eat that, they kind of make their way, these chemicals accumulate and make their way up the food chain. And so for the Fox River and the Bay of Green Bay, our fish that we like to eat, like such as walleye and pike and things like that, they really have high contaminants in them. And so the biggest public health risk is eating contaminated fish.
Let's go to Marcus now, joining us from Milwaukee with a question. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So PCBs and bisphenol A are still being used in plastics for water bottles and other beverages. And so it's been found in many studies that there's microplastics in every body of water on the entire planet. So how much have we really learned from, you know, having to go through this in the Fox Valley, which I don't really feel that, you know, the rest of the world has paid attention and learned anything. And second, what are we going to do to start trying to remediate that problem?
Great questions, Marcus. Julia, what do you think there?
Well, the use of PCBs has been banned since 1976, so those are unlikely what has been in the water bottles currently. There are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of different types of compounds and chemicals that industry uses as of this point. And even maybe today, there's still a little bit of paper recycling still out there, maybe some old office paper if you're cleaning out your office that gets recycled that might still have some PCBs in it. I think I'm not an expert in what exactly is in water bottles at this point. But for PCBs, they were banned in the 76. And after the paper companies actually in this area stopped using them in 71, knowing that they were having impacts to wildlife other places, and you saw a drop, a large drop in the PCB concentrations in wastewater discharge. But as paper was recycled in this area, it was still released into the environment well into the 90s.
Julia, Clint from Wisconsin Rapids called in to ask you if there's anything that can be done for the Wisconsin River. Clint says there are a lot of paper companies in that area, and the river is important to many communities. Is there any testing or cleanup in the future?
Well, one of the, I do not know about the Wisconsin River and whether there's cleanup efforts. I do know, you know, in 1972, when the Clean Water Act was formed, that really helped with these industrial sites and our wastewater treatment sites and starting to put protections into the environment on what they could release into the environment. And so that has had a huge impact on water quality across the nation. That was at a time when, you know, the Cuyahoga River was setting on fire and then Silent Spring came out. So that was the last really large scale federal, you know, water protections that came about. And since then, things have been improving. I would say also with other rivers and other contaminated spots, there's a lot of testing that goes on with discharges in general. It's, you know, they start to look at the bottom sediments and then potentially based on whether our federal agencies find, such as like U.S. Fish and Wildlife or the Environmental Protection Agency or NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, if they come in and start testing, potentially they could bring a suit or bring those responsible parties together to start to fund a cleanup.
So have we become more sophisticated in how we clean up because or how efficiently? I mean, this is a huge price tag, $1.2 billion. What have we learned about these vacuums and how we clean this stuff up?
Yeah, this is actually a really interesting story for our Fox River. So at the time we were taking when the paper company started in 1998, I think, or 99, around the late 90s, the Appleton Paper Company, they were helping try to figure out if the river was going to be cleaned up, what was the best way. So working with the Department of Natural Resources, they brought in consultants and contractors from all over the world to figure out if we were going to clean it up, what would be the absolutely best way. And so some of those techniques and processes were demonstrated up in Lake Butamort area at the upper reaches. And so they made sure that it was the most up-to-date technology. So some of those processes, you know, could be said to be improving what we know today about how cleanup. It definitely became an example across the country of how to clean up a contaminated site.
Would this have looked different today if cleanup had started earlier?
Yes. Of course. I mean, yeah. As soon as we get those river bottom the sediments out, things are going to start improving. I mean, the ecosystems are pretty resilient. And what we saw from the demonstration sites and some of the early work up in Lake Butamort from the dredging is that PCB levels dropped precipitously almost immediately. And even quick, they looked at PCB levels in walleye. And after that cleanup, just within a few years, PCB levels had dropped over 70% already.
Wow.
And so that's very exciting for thinking about the future. So getting those contaminants out of the river is going to have a really large impact on our fish.
Well, Dave from Menasha called in to ask if any testing has been done to the fish in those water sources and fishing. He's a fisherman and could actually taste the difference in the fish from polluted areas to those that were cleaner.
Yes, I've heard anecdotal stories like that myself from my family members who, you know, back in the day they fished in the Fox River also. There were in that time, I'm not certain about the chemical properties of PCBs in terms of smell, but there are other chemicals through the papermaking process that could potentially make them taste or smell off.
Wow. Yeah. So even very certain chemical combinations can have an impact on what that fish may taste like.
Yes, but I would say today where they have been looking at fish taste levels, and a lot of those chemicals have actually been stopped in use.
So as we look toward 2020, when this cleanup job is expected to be completed, where will we be at this point? And is that timeline seem compatible with what needs to be done?
Originally the dredging was supposed to be completed in 2017, but as the project came to an end, things became more complicated based on coming closer to the Fox River and some just unanticipated dredging complications. So, but this year they are hoping that dredging and capping will be completed, but it really depends on the weather and some of the planning elements of the responsible parties. If not, I think 2020 is definitely everything will be wrapped up completely.
How many people does this take? Is this a pretty big operation?
Oh, it's yes, it's a very large, and I'm sorry, I don't have those numbers in front of me. I do know that, you know, we to this point, we've had over 131,000 truckloads of sediment go to a landfill. They have dredged out 5.4 million cubic yards, which is a lot. 3 million tons of sediment has been processed and taken out of the river. So
we are learning about PCBs in the Fox River and what the cleanup effort is looking like as three paper companies agree to the cost of remediation. The remaining cleanup could add up to more than $1.2 billion. Julia Nordyke is a water quality and coastal communities outreach specialist at the UW Sea Grant Institute. You can join in along the way at 800-642-1234. What do you think are the biggest lessons we've learned from the Fox River and Green Bay PCB pollution? What should policymakers, cities, and Wisconsin residents take away from this? What needs to change for future cleanup efforts? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Coming up, it's news, then we'll continue talking about how to manage PCB remediation waste with your thoughts along the way. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about PCB polluters and who will cover the costs to finish cleaning up the Fox River. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last week, a federal judge approved the settlement calling for three paper companies that polluted the Fox River in Green Bay with chemicals decades ago to cover about $1.2 billion in remaining cleanup work. According to the DNR, remediation began in 1998. It's expected to conclude next year. What have you witnessed when it comes to PCB pollution and cleanup in your area? How has it changed your community? What questions do you have about the cleanup process or the health of the river today? We're at 800-642-1234. Julia Nordyke is a water quality and coastal communities outreach specialist at the UW Sea Grant Institute, and she stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now with Kathy joining us from Peshtigo. Kathy, hi. Kathy, are you there?
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yep. Hi. Yeah, we've had recent flooding in the area, and Green Bay, the Fox River, did flood and impacted homes. So I was wondering if there are PCBs in that water that maybe those homeowners should be aware of. Are there anything they should pay attention to and clean up?
Yeah, what should homeowners pay attention to when the Fox River floods, Julia?
Sure. Well, it's very unlikely there's going to be you're going to have to worry about PCB in floodwaters. So most of the PCBs are attached to the sediment at the bottom of the river. Not to say that they can't gradually be released and dissolved into the water column. However, I would say that with floodwaters, a lot of that is also stormwater that's coming off our roads and our driveways and our streets and our parking lots, and that can actually have high levels of other types of pollutants. Think about oil dripping from your car. Brake pad dust there's high metals in our stormwater runoff. So we definitely do not encourage people to be playing or recreating in flooded floodwaters.
Kathy, thanks for the call. Julia, as we get a handle on PCBs, what is the situation with phosphorus runoff and the river, and how do we deal with it? Is there a cleanup approach?
Yes, so this is the biggest challenge that we have moving forward to restore the health of the lower Fox River in the Bay of Green Bay. And right now, because we have so much land in agricultural production, some of our practices have a lot of soil erosion lost. And so this is some of the best, you know, topsoil in the country, and we don't really want it going into the bay. So how do we approach this enormous problem? Well, there is a lot of great work being done through the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which is a federal funding initiative to restore the Great Lakes, also which has helped fund a lot of the cleanups, toxin cleanups around the Great Lakes. But some of this work is really working with agricultural producers in the region to start to develop conservation practices and really restore the soil health. We want to make sure that when the snow melts or the rain falls, that rather than running off into the ditch and taking with it a lot of their topsoil, that it's actually infiltrating into the ground. And so it helps with potentially with in the future with their soil being more resilient to these large swings in climate too. And so just keeping that soil on the fields is kind of the goal moving forward.
Will we be decades from now in a similar situation with remediation for runoff?
It is potential. There are potentially, as we dredge the Fox River now, we are taking out a lot of sediment and phosphorus at the same time. So that could be in the future, and for smaller maybe tributaries to the Fox River, dredging could potentially be a way to remove phosphorus, and that has been done in the past in other lakes and other streams. But at this point, the approach really is to work with the producers and get these conservation practices on the ground that help infiltrate the soil and make it more resilient to these big storm events. And there is what's called the Fox Demo Farm Network out here, and there's some really great producers demonstrating these practices on the land and inviting other producers and farmers to come see those practices.
Do you think those demos are making an impact? Do you see the research proving that we can contain this runoff better than we're doing right now?
A lot of these demonstration farms just were established maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And so working with the USGS and the university system, they started baseline monitoring of water quality from these farm fields. And then they're starting to implement these practices. So the monitoring of this and the research is currently ongoing. And so that is exactly what they're trying to demonstrate, that these practices will improve water quality. And so we're just a little early in the process before we can make absolute conclusions. But it's looking good in general.
Let's go to Andy now, joining us from Libertyville. Andy, hi.
Hi, good morning. My question is, I thought I heard that President Trump is trying to slash the Great Lakes water, the budget for cleaning up the Great Lakes, and I was wondering if that has any impact on what's going on in Wisconsin and the water quality there.
Andy, thanks for the call. And how is the funding flowing for Great Lakes restoration, Julia?
So the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative began in 2009, and since then it has had strong bipartisan support across the region, and current funding levels have been at $300 million for the region. And that money has gone to restoring habitat, wildlife and fish and habitat, cleaning up these toxic hotspots across the Great Lakes, and then also starting to work on reducing agricultural runoff in our area and then also in areas like Lake Erie and the Maumee River. Now, the budget that the Trump administration just put out actually decreased the $300 million to $30 million. And so that would definitely have a large impact on restoration efforts moving forward.
Talking with Julia Nordyk, she is a water quality and coastal communities outreach specialist at the UW Sea Grant Institute, looking at the efforts to clean up PCBs in the Fox River, looking at efforts to contain runoff. Julia, you spend your whole day thinking about water. Are we paying more attention to water quality now than we have in past decades?
That's hard to say because I wasn't there in past decades. However, I think, a lot of things kind of are going in cycles depending on the level of the impacts that we're seeing. So, back in the early 60s, we were at a pretty low point. And that's when, again, the Cuyahoga River set on fire and Silent Spring came about. And we started to see the effects of DDT and some of the chemicals that we're having on our lives. And so here in the Fox River, that it took a lot of the research and the science to show the impacts, and then and those cycles of kind of people starting to do that research and then finding out about the impacts and not being okay with it, and then so having basically public outcry in general. So, I mean, there was originally at a time when nothing was protected, and you know, 1938 was the first Wisconsin statewide water quality survey, and from because in the Fox River they had stopped actually taking ice out of the river, and it just smelled so bad that, you know, there's documents of potentially putting perfume over the East River up here to drown out the stench. So when it seems that when people start to pay attention more, and our issues more are with, you know, they've been changing over the years. So it was toxics in the 60s and 70s, and right now we're really focused on, you know, groundwater and surface water quality in terms of drinking and these harmful algal blooms that are occurring.
Let's take it down to a personal level. What steps or actions would be most helpful for our water in our personal life? What could we do as households?
As a household, basically, we have all these hard surfaces coming off our driveways and our roofs and things, and we do contribute stormwater to these systems. And a lot of that stormwater isn't treated. And so if we think about the heavy metals and the oils that and the fertilizers and the pesticides that we might be using on our lawns, those could end up directly in our local rivers, creeks, and streams, and eventually into the lake. We want to also protect against bacteria and cleaning up our dog poop, and then also, you know, really maybe not washing your car in your driveway, but on the grass, so those the soaps don't get into the storm drain. We can do a lot around lawn clippings and keeping the leaves and your lawn clipping on your lawn rather than going down into the storm drain.
And when you're looking at algae blooms and what's ahead for this summer, is there any way that we can predict or know what it's going to be like?
For the Green Bay, the Bay of Green Bay, right mm-hmm. now, we do not have very good predictive models of what it will be. But the trends have been that we do get a blue-green algae bloom every summer, typically starting in early July and then going potentially all the way to October. And so that season is starting to extend as our region becomes warmer and wetter. And so when our region becomes wetter, we have more soil and more nutrients entering the Bay of Green Bay. And then being warmer and calm and shallow in the lower bay here, we're going to have a longer extended harmful algal bloom.
Well, Julia, we really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Julia Nordyke is a water quality and coastal communities outreach specialist. She's with the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute. And we've been talking about PCB cleanup in the Fox River and the remediation steps that are underway and said to extend to 2020. Coming up, how do you gradually get off an antidepressant after years of taking it? There's not a one-size-fits-all protocol to getting off these meds. We'll learn about it ahead here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. We're learning how to wean from antidepressants on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A recent study is saying that 4 weeks is too short of a time to get off these meds, and the process should take longer, months, not weeks. And that's a departure in thinking for the millions of Americans who take antidepressants for depression and anxiety. Many people stop them without much trouble, but others, the side effects are really difficult. Have you gone off of antidepressants? How did your physician advise you to taper your dosage, and how did it go? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Dee Mangan is Associate Chair and Director of Research and a professor in the Department of Family Medicine at McMaster University in Ontario. Dr. Mangan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on this morning. I've been enjoying listening to the show as I've waited to talk to you.
Well, based on your clinical experience and on recent research, what do we know about how to taper the dosage for a period of time?
Well, what we know has very much been evolving over time, I think. And what we know now is that for the range, as you were saying, the range of experience that people have in trying to stop these medications is quite broad. We know that some people can, in fact, even stop dead with no problems. But we know for a large proportion of people, they do have significant withdrawal symptoms when they go about stopping. And what we know now is that it's not perhaps like other medications when you can stop over perhaps a period of weeks with a linear that is a drop in dose that's the same with each step down. What we know now is that it's the last part of the taper that can be the most difficult, and that we should really, for the whole process of withdrawal, take a very slow and gentle approach, and particularly over that last period of the withdrawal, take extremely small steps down and really wait after each of those small steps till things have settled for the patient before we think about the next step down.
What are the symptoms? What does that withdrawal look like? How severe can it be?
Well, as I said before, there's a real range in severity, but the withdrawal symptoms cover a number of domains, some of which might be expected, but some of which perhaps people might not expect. So they cover physical symptoms. Often there are flu-like symptoms, really, at the beginning, so fatigue, a feeling of lethargy, perhaps some muscle aches and chills. Then there are gut upset symptoms, so it's kind of not surprising that we get stomach upset when we start or stop antidepressants, because there are actually more serotonin receptors in the gut than there are in the brain. So people might expect nausea or vomiting or diarrhea as they stop as well. Some people feel a sense of being off balance, so a sense sometimes of vertigo or unsteadiness. Other people, and this is probably the one that's not expected and can be alarming, some people experience unusual sensations, so tingling or electric shock sensations, and patients have sometimes described these as brain zaps. The other people can have sleep disturbance, so very vivid dreams or trouble sleeping. And then the most confusing symptom, I think, is that people can have a sense of psychological lability or ups and downs. So they can feel agitated or anxious or have bouts of crying for no reason, or feel low for relatively short periods of time for no reason. And you can see these kind of symptoms, along with some of the physical symptoms. It's easy to get confused between symptoms that are actually just to do with stopping the drug and symptoms that might indicate that the depression is returning.
Dr. Mangan, antidepressants have been a big breakthrough for modern medicine. We know that long-term prescription rates of antidepressants have doubled over the past decade in the U.S. and the U.K. Do we know what's behind that?
Probably a number of things. And antidepressants, like most classes of drugs, we have to kind of hold two truths at the same time. One is that they can do good, and the other is that they can have harmful effects as well. And what we've certainly seen is, since about the late 1990s, early 2000s, since the newer SSRI or Prozac-like group of drugs was introduced to the market, there's been a steady climb in the number of people who are taking these medications, to the extent that if you went out on the street in Wisconsin and looked around you, probably 1 in 10 of the adults around you will be currently taking one of these medicines. But what we know about that rise is that it's not necessarily that we're spotting depression more and treating it, but what we know is that more people are going on and staying on these medicines long term. And it may be that these difficulties that people have stopping, or some people, and the confusion often with the symptoms of stopping with perhaps a recurrence of the depression, may be in part driving that increase in long term use.
Talking with Dr. Dee Mangan, she's Associate Chair and Director of Research and a professor in the Department of Family Medicine at McMaster University in Ontario, looking at new research about going off of antidepressants and the impact of what it means to taper off. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Mangan, what would you recommend clinicians and patients do when the time comes to go off an antidepressant? What is the course of action? What should those conversations be like between the physician and patient?
That's a great question. So I think the conversation really needs to start at the time of the decision to start the medication. So there needs to be a sort of a shared conversation about how long the course length is, and a usual course length for someone with an early first bout of depression would be between 6 and 12 months, an average of 9 months at least. We know that if you stop earlier than this, it's likely the depression will return. So a planning for when that time will be, and then a planning for a consultation around that time to carefully plan the withdrawal and the monitoring of that withdrawal. It's important that the timing is good, so that there's not much else going on that's distracting in life. For example, if it's Christmas time, family are coming for Christmas, it's a very stressful time often for, you know, that's obviously not a good time to start decreasing your antidepressants as well. So planning for the timing, letting friends and family know that you're planning to withdraw and might need some support, and making sure all those other non-drug ways of getting support are all in place. And then the next thing I would say, and what I do in my own clinical practice, is we do, because it's not possible to predict who might have problems with withdrawal symptoms and need a slower taper and who won't, is to do a test drop, a very small reduction. And I usually try and do a 10% test drop to see, and then see how the person feels with that kind of drop, and then plan the rate of taper after that. But I would say, certainly for people who have been on antidepressants for years, it's good to plan at least that it may take months, or even in some cases years to taper off. And you know, there's no rush. It's better to be gentle and slow than it is to rush and get unpleasant symptoms and perhaps risk not being able to taper off. I think it's always really important that the patient controls the rate of taper according to their symptoms and how severe they are, and that particularly in that last part of the taper, that the steps down become smaller, may need to be smaller and smaller for some people.
You're currently studying how people react when they go off Prozac, which is commonly prescribed as an antidepressant. Where do you hope to take your research?
Well, what we hope to do is to describe in real detail the withdrawal syndrome for the first time, to look to see if we can see anything that helps us predict who may have troubles and who may not. We also are looking to see to what extent long-term use is helpful. There have never been any trials in the primary care population, which is where we know 90% of antidepressants are prescribed. There's never been a trial in that population to be able to let patients know, if they take these medicines long-term, how effective they are at preventing depression recurrence. What we also hope to do is try and give some idea of what proportion of patients have been on antidepressants long term are likely to have these kind of problems. The traditional thinking has been, in fact, with Prozac, which has what's called a very long half-life, or it takes a long time to clear from the body, it's thought that had no or very little problems for people in terms of withdrawal symptoms. But certainly our investigator group knew from our clinical practice, and it's it looks like it's likely to be confirmed by the trial, that even when you're taking a drug like Prozac, and even when you taper, you still a proportion of people will have these withdrawal symptoms.
Dr. Mangan, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Dee Mangan is Associate Chair, Director of Research, and a professor in the Department of Family Medicine at McMaster University in Ontario. Up next, the Wisconsin Maritime Museum and Door County Maritime Museum are joining forces to offer more than 100 nautical events as they celebrate their 50th anniversaries. We'll hear more about that as we explore maritime history. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.